worldwide, radio.dominican.edu. I am your host, Barbara McVeigh. So we have big things to talk about here on Take Back, and we have an agenda. As our planet faces global climate change, melting polar ice caps, and ocean acidification, and we like to remain positive. There's hope. We're still alive. Here at Take Back, we try to get deep into understanding these issues and ask big questions about what does it mean to be human, and where are we going wrong on planet Earth? Here on Take Back, we have thinkers, poets, writers, and educators. Help us get it right and navigate this crazy journey called life. Maybe we'll get inspired to make some big changes and look at who we have been and why. So today, here on Take Back, we're talking about oceans, and I'm so excited to talk with my two guests, Michael Stocker, Director of Ocean Conservation Research, and Cassie Birdie-Shaw, Advocacy and Policy Director of Turtle Island Restoration Network. They're joining me to talk about our vital oceans and what's happening and what we can do. So welcome, Michael and Cassie, to Take Back.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for this opportunity.
Yeah, well, Michael, I've known you for a number of years, and Cassie, I met you at the Huffman and Pelosi Ocean event last week, and it was an instant connection.
Oceans
do that to us, don't they? Michael, tell us about your work. You've been working with the oceans with your nonprofit for a number of years. What's been going on?
Yeah, I come from a long line of people who've been on the ocean. My grandfather ran away from home in 1889 and became a cabin boy on a ship, and he ended up sailing the seas. And from a syntactical standpoint, actually, the National Science Foundation, about a decade ago, said that there's no plural for ocean, that it's one system. And looking at it that way, I'm a systems thinker. I have been working really specifically on the impacts of noise pollution on marine habitat. And there's an awful lot of new noises coming into the ocean since the mechanization of transportation, so shipping, and along with that, the militarization of the high seas, and also a lot of technology going into extract resources that all use acoustical sensing and acoustical communication equipment. And I'm seeing a significant impact of that. And I was concerned about this back in 92 when the Navy was proposing a full ocean communication system to basically track submarines and communicate with submarines surreptitiously. But they were going to be broadcasting noise in the entire sea everywhere, and I thought that was a pretty bad idea. I came out of physics and acoustics, doing a lot of work in the music industry, and I found that one of the shortcomings that the environmental argument had was the people who were making it were not conversant in science, and they're being dismissed by the folks who are proposing these technical programs because these guys are physical oceanographers and they know all about science, but they didn't know much about biology. So I found myself kind of in a nice kind of niche market where I would be able to converse with the scientists about the physics of the issue and converse with the biologists about the biology of the issue, and also kind of keep this at a public intelligibility level. It wasn't because people were passionate about something. They didn't necessarily understand the language behind, but they were wanting some resolution of this problem that's facing us.
So sound out in the ocean, why should that be a concern? What is it doing to the habitats out there, to the marine life?
Well, the acoustics of the ocean is really the dominant sensing system. It's dark at night in the ocean, and you get down deep, and while there is bioluminescence, which is used in kind of short-range communication, in a healthy ocean system, visibility is very poor. If you have a lot of plankton in it, you might be able to see just a few yards, even in the daytime. And you get down pretty deep, and visibility is not the strongest perception of the sea. So most of the animals, from the invertebrates all the way up to the complex vertebrates, use acoustical energy to sense their surroundings and do all the things that animals need to do to get around, which is to breed, to find prey, to avoid predation. And so when we start adding noise to that, we start masking biologically significant signals. Now, these animals, you know, have been sometimes hundreds of millions of years adapting to various types of noises in the ocean, so they can maybe discriminate proximity or discriminate good noise from bad noise in ways that maybe terrestrial animals don't have that, you know, the capacity. Nonetheless, we are seeing a lot of impacts of animals being disrupted, their feeding patterns being disrupted, their migratory paths being disrupted. They're, in some cases, in catastrophic situations, we have strandings of marine mammals whose ears have been blown out by noises, military noises particularly. But we have situations where we're really colonizing the sea with our noise, and there's a lot of impacts we're seeing in all the way up and down the food chain, from the phytoplankton and the zooplankton all the way up to the marine mammals.
I remember in the film by Dennis DeLastrick, it's a film called Freightant, and it's about the freighting industry. And I think we're up to, I could have this wrong, but I'll have to double check, 60,000 ships out at sea at a time. And that even just the carbon that it's the ships are emitting, it's, you know, equivalent to a small country like Germany. But that's not the only thing. It's about the sound that these ships give off. That's quite devastating to the animals. Do you think that they have an effect on the marine life?
Well, the ocean is 10 times louder now than it was just 40 years ago, and this is largely due to international shipping. And there are something like 95,000 boats registered with Lloyd's. If you just say maybe half of them are at sail at any given time, that's, you know, 45,000 boats that are on the ocean making noise. It is significantly affecting animal life, but it's hard to measure because there's so many other stressors in the sea right now, in terms of just you know, different types of pollution. But one of the kind of clear examples of where this is probably making a difference is if you look at the North Atlantic right whale. It's an endangered animal, and there are less than 500 of them remaining. They were over-harvested, over-fished back in the whaling days because they were very easy to get. They didn't sink when you shot them, and they were, you know, near the shore, and they were on the surface. And so they called them the right whale because they were the right whale to get. They decimated the populations in the North and the South Atlantic equally, so it got to a point where the fishery was no longer commercially viable. And in 1984, finally, a global moratorium on whaling was allowing these animals to recover. Well, in the North Atlantic, they didn't recover very well. There's only, as said, less than 500. But they're recruiting and recovering quite well in the South Atlantic. I mean, there's thousands of them now. And probably the most clear systematic difference between the North Atlantic and the South Atlantic are the shipping lanes. It's quiet in the South Atlantic, and the North Atlantic is not. And then some colleagues, Susan Parks, is doing a bioacoustics of these animals up in the Bay of Fundy, recording their sounds. And she was working concurrently with a woman, Rosalind Rowland, who's doing basically stress evaluations by measuring cortisol levels in the feces of these animals. And something happened in 2001, on September 11th, where all of the shipping lanes were kind of shut down for a week globally. The ocean got quiet, and they saw the cortisol levels plummet. This is a stress, a proxy for stress. So it plummeted when the shipping levels, shipping noise went down. And when the shipping started up again, the cortisol levels, you know, rose concurrently. So it was pretty clear that the shipping noise itself is creating a stress level in these animals. And stress in any animal, including humans, is counterproductive.
Of course.
Reproductive or miscarriage rates in the flight path of airports is, you know, 10 to 15% higher than it is in adjacent areas. That's with humans.
I remember reading how whales, that they can actually hear from very far distances. I mean, their ability to hear is incredible. Is that true?
Well, they can make sounds which they can, you can hear a blue whale's vocalization 2,000 or 3,000 miles away. And there's a reason for that. They wouldn't just be making a loud noise because they're large. They probably use that signal for something, either communicating with conspecifics I'm doing a lot of work on chorusing of these workles, that they might be chorusing like crickets at long distances like that, which give them an idea of what's happening with their community. Mm-hmm. They could also be using it as navigation signals. There's a guy, Dr. Chris Clark, who's at Cornell University, really kind of one of the superstars of the bioacoustics world in the ocean. And he looked at how these blue whales were migrating, and they were tracking physical features in the ocean, like seamounts and canyons and ledges. And his thought was that they were probably sensing those through long-distance echolocation. So it's important signals that these animals need to hear back when they make those. Maybe they're like bats, but instead of using high-frequency signals at close range, they're using low-frequency signals at long range. And that's probably how they're navigating. Now, if we fuzz up that signal or we mask it with industrial noise, they're not going to be able to do that as effectively. And at some point in time, we might meet a threshold where they can't do it at all.
I remember many hours laying next to a record player when I was a child and listening to the sounds of whales on my record album. Oh, it was beautiful.
That's probably Roger Payne's Songs of the Humpback Whale.
They were beautiful. Cassie, you've been doing some great work with ocean conservation issues and so forth. What's been going on in your world?
Yes, so I come at this from a little bit different background than Michael had mentioned. I'm from Ohio, a pretty landlocked state, but you don't have to grow up near the ocean or on the ocean to be a deep lover of the ocean. And so there are so many reasons to fall in love with the ocean, the majestic wildlife, so many services that the ocean provides. So I grew up seeing movies like Free Willy and cartoons like Captain Planet, and realized right away I really identified with the values at the core of those things, and how animals have a value unto their own and not simply as services or food for people, for instance. And so now I am working with Turtle Island Restoration Network, which has been around for about 30 years, and they work on a variety of ocean conservation issues. For instance, we have an office in the Gulf of Mexico that does sea turtle nesting projects, getting volunteers out to the beach to monitor the nests and make sure they're protected from predators and human threats. And so a lot of the work that we do out here in California, which is the main part of my work, is combating irresponsible commercial fishing practices. And so best example of that is the drift gillnet fishery that happens off California's coast. So this fishery uses mile-long nets. If you imagine the Golden Gate Bridge, the net would stretch almost the entire way across and hang down from the bottom into the water. So these are the nets that are left out overnight, ostensibly to catch swordfish, but for every swordfish they catch more than two other animals. And many of these animals are thrown away. Some of them can be marketed as well, but a lot of them are dead when they're pulled up, or they're able to be released alive, but Michael had mentioned stress to animals from acoustics, and there are all kinds of stresses that we as human beings are putting on animals, and certainly dragging them up from the depths of the ocean is certainly stressful for them. And so many of those animals, even if they're able to be released, aren't able to continue to survive and thrive as they would have otherwise. So this fishery is actually banned in many places. Along the West Coast, Washington and Oregon have stopped using this fishing method. Florida has a constitutional amendment against this fishing method, and they switched over to a different, closer to sustainable gear. So the best idea is to let wild animals be wild animals, and for them to live out their lives. But if people are going to decide to consume seafood, there are a spectrum of ways to do that, and you can do so responsibly, choosing fishing methods or suppliers that harm very few other animals and don't put that particular stock of fish that you're eating in danger. Or there are things like drift gillnet fishing, things like long lining that basically destroys ocean environments, can destroy the stocks of fish that people are eating, and also have a huge amount of bycatch, which means unintended catch of other species. And so for drift gill net fishing, for swordfish, a lot of the bycatch includes sea turtles, endangered species, sperm whales, dolphins, sea lions, basically you name it, you catch it. It's an incredibly indiscriminate way to fish. So what we do is try to reach out and educate the public so that they can make more responsible seafood choices, whether they're going to consume it at all, and if they are choosing to eat swordfish, for instance, produced by more responsible gear called deep set buoy gear or harpoon gear. And you can ask restaurants, you can ask markets, hey, where does this come from? Where did you get it? And that's part of being a responsible consumer. So in addition to reaching out to consumers, we try to do administrative advocacy. We do advocacy through lawsuits, basically take any tack that we need to try to tackle these important ocean conservation issues.
So let me get this right. Florida, Washington, Oregon have all eliminated drift, how do you say it again?
Drift gill net fishing.
Yeah. But California has not.
So it's a nuance issue a little bit, so forgive me for getting into the details. So California also does not allow this fishing in state waters, but they do permit it and help to regulate it to allow this fishing in federal waters. So if you go just a few miles off the coast, that's where a lot of these animals are anyway, that is where they use these mile-long nets. And so these other states that we're referring to, they don't allow it in state waters, and it also does not happen in federal waters. So California is the only state in the United States where this is used to catch swordfish. And this method has also been banned by the United Nations, by Russia, and by the United States at a larger scale level. So what they've done is ban nets 2 miles wide approximately. But when you cut the problem in half, you're not getting rid of it. Mile-long nets add up to have the same level of destruction. In fact, these nets, they are among the 20% worst fisheries in the world. So we think of the United States and we think of California as being environmentally progressive, and you know that we're doing so much better than so many other places. But this fishery, in terms of how many marine mammals that it harms, it is amongst the worst fisheries in the world.
So we have an opportunity to improve.
We definitely have a lot of
room to improve. This is the time to do it. And it's good to talk about it. It's not about shining the light on bad things. It's the time to really look at it square in the face and say, okay, we need to change this.
Right. Finding a problem and finding a solution. So the problem is very evident and we're presenting solutions.
I know Dr. Sylvia Earle is a big one. I mean, we love Dr. Sylvia Earle, one of the most important oceanographers of our time at 80. I think she'll be 82 this year. Is that right?
Yeah.
Do I have that right? I was at an event at her studio about a year ago talking about these gill nets, and we were just twisting ourselves up in them. The kids were too, and just going, you know, I at that time I thought we didn't use them anymore, but you're telling us that we do. Wow. Okay, so we've got some problems with our oceans. What's going on with ocean acidification? I mean, I've been hearing a lot of talk about what's going on with the pH levels and our coral reefs. Do any of you know about this issue?
Yes, and this actually is kind of on the same arc of this problem with how do we fuel our economy. And oddly enough, the first time I got involved in ocean noise pollution issues, the Navy was involved in part of it, but there was a program called Acoustic Thermography of Ocean Climate. And the idea was that there's a direct correlation between how fast sound travels and how warm it is. And there is an isothermic layer down deep that for the last 10,000 years has been the exact, you know, 4 degrees centigrade, essentially. And the thought was that if you could measure an increase in temperature down there, it would verify global warming. This is back, 92, 25 years, 30, long time ago, 25 years ago. And we knew that global warming was happening, but there was another foot-dragging routine that people are getting into. So we want to verify it. Before we start acting on it, we want to verify it. Well, if you do the physics of this thing, this body of water, which is anywhere from 300 to 3,000 feet deep and below, down to the bottom of the ocean, down to 12,000 feet, if that body of water has been the same temperature, 4 degrees centigrade, for 10,000 years, a movement of just a hundredth of a degree would already be thermal runaway. And they were wanting to verify this within those error bar ranges. It's like trying to essentially forestall doing any kind of action on fossil fuel carbon dioxide pollution until we quote unquote knew for sure. Well, the latest check is that particular body of water, which is a huge amount of the surface of the planet, has increased by 300 of a degree centigrade. So we're not just in thermal runaway, we're just in it's a train wreck in motion. That being said, there are a lot of other components to the ocean and carbon dioxide as well. It's the major sink of carbon dioxide on the planet is the ocean.
Meaning the ocean is absorbing the carbon.
Absorbs it,
yeah.
and converts it to various types of compounds, including carbonic acid. Well, the carbonic acid is what the acidification is being caused by. And what is happening as a consequence of that, and we have this very beautiful balanced chemical system in this planet that is being disrupted fairly rapidly. Animals that use calcium carbonate to build their shells, the coccolithophores that create the oxygen that we breathe, and the corals and a lot of marine invertebrates work around this calcium shell, that is being eaten away. And so the life that depends on, and we're talking coccolithophores are dinky little animals, are kind of half zooplankton, half phytoplankton. It's an interesting little kind of carbon arbor with this photosynthetic envelope around it. But it essentially, they're not able to build the skeleton that they need to stretch their bodies around. And as a consequence of that, our very oxygen supply on the planet, like 3 out of every 5 breaths come from these animals, that's being threatened by the acidification of the ocean. That's at the smallest level.
This is Michael Stalker, Director of Ocean Conservation Research. We're here at Take Back Radio talking about ocean issues. Along with us is Cassie Birdieshaw, Advocacy and Policy Director, Turtle Island Restoration Network. And we're talking about big ocean issues, I guess, big global issues. And what we're just talking about right now is ocean acidification and how the pH of our oceans are changing. And Michael Stalker was just talking about every 3 breaths that we take?
3 out of every 5 breaths. I mean, it's a number, but it's more than half of the oxygen that we breathe.
Our oxygen comes from the ocean, and our oceans are acidifying. I would say that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, it is kind of a big deal. And I don't know, in a million years, there's going to be complex vertebrates on the planet. But in the next 150 years, these things, as these systems start collapsing, somebody's going to be wagging their finger at the fossil fuel company for basically dragging their feet on this stuff.
Dr. Sylvia Earle says if the things of what we do in the next 10 years will have consequences for the next 10,000 years. Sounds like pretty logical, wouldn't you say, Cassie?
Yeah, and we're talking about a lot of species that are really on the brink. For instance, the Pacific leatherback sea turtle has declined over 90% of its population over the last couple decades. And so we need to be making good choices right away. And I was over the summer at the International Sea Turtle Symposium, and the takeaway message from all kinds of world-renowned scientists studying populations all over the world was that we need to address climate change. There are all kinds of problems, habitat destruction, illegal trade in different species, all kinds of problems that these animals are facing. But the bottom line is we really need to address climate change and this carbon dioxide and absorption and how much we're putting into the atmosphere, to continue as a species, as you were alluding to, and for all these other species to continue to exist on our planet as well. So we want to maintain a world sort of, as we know, with a lot of these amazing creatures, for us to be able to go and whale watch and to go and snorkel and scuba dive with.
And breathe oxygen.
Yeah.
Right.
And as we talk about these big topics, you know, I don't want people to be overwhelmed and basically think that, oh my goodness, this is such a large problem with so many, you know, corporations putting contaminants out, and what am I going to do? So pick something and do it. So there are a lot of actions to take, and you can pick one species to help conserve. You can pick, you know, one thing to go after, and just make sure that, you know, you are taking actions. There are a lot of people out there who care about this, and the more people who do decide to even take small actions, those things really do add up.
I think all of us have gotten into some bad habits that have been generating for, well, at least a few decades, and I'll get to that in a minute, but I always like to refer to what Mark Twain says. Did you know he never finished high school, Mark Twain?
No.
I did not.
Yeah, I just learned this myself. He was a brilliant man, and he says education consists mostly of what we unlearn, and I feel that that's what we need to do, is we need to unlearn some of the nasty habits that we've all learned. So Michael, we were talking about some Reagan policies, my favorite person. Actually, you know what? Reagan inspired me to start radio. Did you know that?
Oh,
this radio
that?
Show was actually inspired by Ronald Reagan. So yeah, he's not all bad. But you were talking about some policies that he had initiated during his administration. Could you talk about that?
Well, I think from a systematic standpoint, we can use Reagan as a hinge pin of the place where we started taking things that were really germane to civil society, like education, like medicine, like food supply, fishing, farming, and commoditizing it, turning it into a way of making money. Not that money wasn't being made before doing these things, but that was not the objective. The objective of a company, of a farmer, was to produce food. The product of a fishing family was to catch fish and sell the fish so they could feed themselves. What ended up happening in the Reagan years, and I think it's endemic in a lot of the different policies that he executed, but one of the things that's important to the ocean conversation is that he extended the sovereign ocean, federal sovereign ocean, out another 200 miles. And they did that Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. They did that because we had a Navy defend it. Prior to that time, you could see Japanese boats and Norwegian boats and Russian boats fishing within 12 miles of our shore because there was no high seas regulation at that point in time. Well, he effectively expanded the geographical footprint of the United States, doubling it. And with that, concurrent with that, they created a fishing industry which was really based on commoditizing fish. They overfunded the fishing industry, thinking that it was going to be a bottomless supply of protein. They created these large factory trawlers that were served by smaller fishing lighters, and they were just out at sea all the time, just sucking up protein as fast as possible. They had fishing management councils that were supposed to regulate this. The fishing management councils constituted the fishermen, because they knew what was going on up there, and they wanted to make money, and the bankers that actually had funded these large fishing fleets. So their priorities were also to try to maximize financial yield. Now we have a situation where fishermen are not catching fish, they're catching money. And it's very difficult to regulate around that stuff from a systematic standpoint. Interestingly enough, the bill that created these fishing councils was called the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And, you know, it's a work in progress, but every few years, every 5 years, you have to kind of review it. And we worked on it for a couple of different cycles. Up until 2010, they had scientists as advisory board members, but they were not voting board members. And finally, we got scientists on as voting board members. But they would, you know, I had friends who were, you know, advising these councils, and they were basically you know, telling their friends in the back of the room, or fishermen, like, get out of the business, because they would say, well, what would be they would be asked what would be the, you know, a sustainable yield of herring off of the coast of the central coast of California, and they say, well, maybe, you know, 40 metric tons or something like that. And they would always be asked, well, what are the error bars, you know, plus or minus how much? And they say, well, you know, maybe 5%, 10%, something like that. Okay, so we'll set the limit at 45 metric tons, always to the higher level, because they, you know, was quote unquote scientifically sustainable or supportable. But it ended up basically turning, like a lot of our other, like education, like medicine, into money factories and not into producing educated people, healthy people, food supply, what have you. So it was really kind of the beginning of this runaway train that we're on right now.
Well, and that's so interesting, because there was an environmental decade, the 1970s is noted as the environmental decade, where there was incredible work being made at that time with various nonprofit organizations and Wilderness Society and Earth Day and so many. The Energy Department was established under Carter in order to get off fossil fuels. You had the solar panels, the wind energy, and was making these incredible moves at that time. And he even said that, I think it was his Crisis of Confidence speech, 1979, and I refer to this a lot because this was the pivotal cultural switch in this country, where he said we're beginning to value people for what, how much they have, and not for what they do. So it seems like this Reagan was the one who could take that to the next level.
Really, yeah, definitely. That's kind of a neoliberal idea of being a simple metric. There were a lot of things at the time that, I mean, there was a lot of unrest on the school campuses because we were involved in fairly unjust corporate actions around the world that that students were wise to and trying to pull the plug on. And the universities were seen as really a hotbed of dissent as opposed to a place where critical thinking could be cultivated. Seeing the universities as quote-unquote the enemy, Ronald Reagan's policies in California was to eviscerate the funding for the university system here, replacing it with a corporate curriculum criteria. And, you know, it's kind of a larger complex issue, but you know, at the end of Pat Brown, who was Jerry Brown's dad, he had a couple terms in California, and the California education system was second to none in the world. Ronald Reagan got in there with a couple of different tax propositions. Prop 13 still kind of rings true. Even people who were born well after that have heard of Prop 13. And the essentially directing of educational curriculum by corporations to turn out, quote-unquote, people who had job skills as opposed to people who had critical thinking skills. By the end of two terms that Ronald Reagan was the governor of California, we were number 48 in the states in terms of our education system. So he took that brilliant idea to the national level and became president after his governorship here. And we now have an education system which is still, you know, holding its own as best as possible, but we're turning out essentially students as commodities, being students that have job skills as opposed to people who are just educated and then can try to, you know, create their own marketplace.
I have two kids. I actually homeschooled my kids for 4 years, recognizing the format for education that I saw my kids going through in the public schools. And my takeaway was that they're being trained to be workers and not thinkers. They're learning how to do things what they're told to do on a really great level, but not to question. That was one of my observations, one of my critical observations of that. And I just kind of wonder, given where we are today, if that holds true. The homeschooling movement is a big force right now with a lot of independent groups. And it amazes me why we don't have more charter schools. We have choices in so many app devices, cereals, everything else, but we don't question public school education on a level that's a healthy level, you know, and offer. There are a lot of different ways to educate. I'm just going to add one more thing to that. My ocean film that you know that I made with Dr. Sylvia Earle, it was so alarming to me when I went around our schools to show that film, and even teachers didn't know that we get oxygen from the ocean. What's gone wrong? Cassie, I want to hear more about your efforts. I also got to ask you, you're doing nonprofit work. You're from Ohio, and you're out here working hard for our oceans. Why aren't you in a corporate job making big money? And I'm sure you're making big bucks at the nonprofit, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Living big, right?
No, I think that we owe a duty to generations who are coming after us and to the environment. And, sometimes where we got our values is a little bit of a mystery. So I'm sure it's, part family, part what I was reading, all sorts of places that you can find inspiration. But I, even went to law school, and law schools are basically considered by a lot of people a farm for, corporate workers. And the law school where I went, Vermont Law School, actually specializes in environmental law and, not the environmental law of going to work for a corporation and figuring out how you can cut more trees or take more fish out of the ocean, to protect our resources or to protect the environment. And they actually, I like to say, brainwashed us not to climb a corporate ladder, but to do public service. And so there are, people and there are institutions pushing those values. And so, my perspective on Reagan is more from the history books, as he started his presidency before I was born. But, I do think it's disturbing how that shift of cultural values isn't to being intellectual, being questioning, being critical thinkers, but it is to, valuing how much does somebody have, how important are they, how nice of a shirt are they wearing. I don't think that's a value that I want my friends to have, my family to have. And so it's about, for me, my work is trying to devalue that and to put forth more of the values that I believe in, and good stewardship, and how kind is that person. And so, that's what inspires me to do the work. And I think, a lot of my colleagues feel the same way.
I'm going to say thank you, Cassie Bertyshaw, for doing the work you're doing. I mean, I feel what both of you are doing, you've got everyone's backs. While everyone is somehow on the treadmill, and we've gotten into this idea of wealth, that wealth generates happiness, that somehow you earn respect with wealth. And I'm not going to say it's a bad thing, because if you have a little bit of money, it does give you a little bit of power. But is there another form of, let's call it, energy that you can use? And I think you guys are both bringing your own spirits and really sharing your own love for the work you do. And you've got my back and other people's backs, and people aren't paying attention. What's funding like for your organizations? That must be a pretty easy thing to do, since you're doing such great work. You must have a lot of funding that comes in pretty easily.
Well, Todd Steiner is a beastly fundraiser. He's really good at that.
And he's our executive director over at Turtle Island. So, I mean, there are a lot of generous people. There are a lot of generous foundations. But our work is dependent on also the government's work. For instance, we can put rules into place about having observers on the fishing boats so that we know what they're catching, about enforcement of those conservation laws that we put into place. But if the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration doesn't have the funding to really follow through with those rules, then we're talking about paper tigers. No enforcement equals, nobody following the rules, because they know they won't get in trouble for it.
We've got Captain Watson out there, though.
We do have some help, and so I'm certainly appreciative of the Captain Watsons of the world.
And it was amazing that Captain Watson was regarded as a renegade, a dangerous, I think he still is, right, in some parts of the world, where, that guy actually was ahead of all of us. I mean, and I'm not going to approve of all of his methods, but he was saying there's a big problem out here, people wake up, and I think we're all waking up to this big problem now.
Sure, we're in, a continuing age of environmental rollbacks and rollbacks to, a lot of other protections and non-environmental arenas as well. But we, we just need enforcement, and we need to be valuing. One of the things I tell people they can do is to call up your congressperson and say, environmental protections are important. We need funding for the EPA. We need funding for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Do you think that really works by contacting local congressmen? And
It does.
Good.
They shake in their boots when you come and knock on their doors, frankly. And I have been going to Washington, D.C. since 2000 and polishing the marble, as they say. It's interesting that you mentioned enforcement, though, Cassie, because during the Bush years, of course, the Republican Party seems to be pretty hostile to any kind of regulation. And this dates back to the anti-federalist movement back in the beginning of our nation. There's still kind of echoes of that. That being said, they still need to get elected, and people do care about things like our sanctuaries and monuments. You guys met at this hearing last week where Jared Huffman and Nancy Pelosi were in attendance, as well as Jackie Spears, yeah, I'm trying to remember. So those people are meeting a largely friendly audience. It's a little challenging to get into the offices of people who are not, who are hostile to environmental regulation. When I first started going during the Bush years, at that time Dick Pombo was the head of the House Natural Resources Committee, which is basically kind of the environmental regulatory branch of that side of Congress, and on the House side, and he pulled the word natural out of it. He just called it House Resources Committee, implying that all that stuff out there were resources to be exploited. What was interesting also in those years is I could go to the regulatory agencies and talk to people. They'd take my meetings, they'd take notes and whatever. But it was only after Obama got elected that these guys started calling back and asking for more information, because there was actually money to enforce. That enforcement component was not there during the Bush years. They just completely defunded enforcement. So there were regulators who had jobs. They were just warming their chairs up.
Oh, didn't Bush tell everybody to go shopping after 9/11?
Well, yeah, that was a kind of a revealing the Achilles heel of our economy, I think, as much as anything else. But what we have now, of course, is not only are the enforcement budgets being slashed, the actual regulators are being pulled out of their seats. There was a scientist who was in the climate component of NOAA, who was Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and he was reallocated to taking royalties from oil companies. He gave him a new chair, a new job. And he's a scientist. He's a climate scientist. He doesn't know accounting. And they put him in that job in the hopes that he would basically leave. And they're doing this type of reallocation. They're basically trying to disrupt all of the regulatory agencies at a core level, not just from an enforcement level. So we have to hold our breath for a while, and hopefully that the train wreck will happen, and we're all not going to get destroyed by it. But it's a real tough time right now.
And another example of that deterioration is the California drift gillnet fishery. Michael had referred to the Magnuson-Stevens Act and how it created these fishery management councils. And so the Fishery Management Council for California and a variety of other states is the Pacific Fishery Management Council. It's largely made up of fishermen and the people who are friendly to fishermen's interests. But even the Pacific Fishery Management Council had endorsed setting hard caps for the drift gillnet fishery. And what hard caps are, it means that if a certain number of marine mammals or if a certain number of sea turtles had been caught by the drift gillnet fishery, then the fishery would have had to close down at least temporarily for 1 to 2 years. And so that got approved, it was supported by conservation groups like Turtle Island. It was supported by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, by the Pacific Fishery Management Council. And then they had all said, yep, this is a good idea. We need this protection. And then what happened was the rule was supposed to be promulgated. It was supposed to be put forth by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they withdrew the proposed rule. So the federal government said, nope, actually, this isn't going to be a priority. I've heard all of these experts saying that it's a priority, but there's just no appetite for that right now.
I started to dive. It was a lifetime dream, and I finally got certified, actually, with the Earle family. It was like a moment of my life. I wrote a book about it, called Redemption, How Ronald Reagan Nearly Ruined My Life. to share it with you is my own journey into, on a personal level, of Reagan's policies, because I like to keep pointing the finger and say it's Ronnie's fault. We need a fall guy in this. But with that, I got to go diving in Tasmania during a film festival. And I'll tell you, there was nothing more powerful than feeling it. I was down there, went diving. We were looking for sea dragons in this, it was like kind of a shaggy carpeted kelp area. And we found two, and I was pretty excited about that. I thought, okay, you know, that's fun. I mean, this has been my lifetime dream, and I found sea dragons in Tasmania. Well, that was a short-lived moment of excitement, because my dive master, who was very, very saddened by this, when we got back, and I said, you know, why are you so sad? And he says, I'll tell you, the warming seas are hitting us faster than everyone else. We used to find hundreds of these sea dragons. And the kelp used to be as tall as the water, and now it's just shag carpeting. And these are the visuals that we're seeing very rapidly down here of changes. And nothing got me more down than that, because, you know, people are seeing these changes. Just like you were talking about the coral reefs, 50% of the coral reefs around the planet are gone. Is that correct? Is that what you said?
This last year, with a bleaching event, it bleached over 50% of the global coral reefs. That is significant. If you just take the reef we all know the best, which is the Great Barrier Reef, that is as large as the state of California, as long as the state of California. If you can imagine the California coastline from San Luis Obispo to San Diego being completely bleached out, that no sustainable life is there, I mean, it's falling apart. Will it recover? There's some recovery that happens, we hope, but we should have addressed this 35 years ago when we knew that was happening.
Why didn't we address it 35 years ago?
Well, the oil guys are really behind this. I mean, and there's still cases against Exxon. And Exxon, during the early part of the century, 2000s, they were putting $200 to $300 million into confusing people about climate change. They've known about this for a long time. It was their budget. And you can get a lot of confusion for that kind of money.
You know, it's interesting to me. I was thinking about this at the Huffman Pelosi event, and, you know, I'm going to be really thankful to anyone who's trying to take a stand for our oceans or anything environmental, and it's not easy in this arena dealing with these big guys and these corporations that are, you know, they're runaway. I mean, I'm close to being criminals. I mean, there's a point where you just really have to come clean. I'm not saying that you and Michael, you and Cassie are saying this. I'm saying this. You have to take that responsibility of what's happening. But I also am beginning to feel that we're being a little soft at this stage. We've been down this road before. Carter, our 39th president, tried to address these issues. We knew about global climate change in the 1970s. It's well documented. It's written about. Carter has been shoved down as the weak president all of these years, and yet he was the one trying to do what was right. Now, isn't this a case of somebody trying to do what was right and a bully coming in and taking over, and we've been following that bully this entire time? Because that's what it feels like. And why are we not honoring the people that have been trying to do the good work, like Carter? His 93rd birthday is coming up, and we are going to try to do something for him this year as a community. But isn't this the time where we really need to take stock in the people who are doing the good work and somehow rally? We have a chance right now with California, with Governor Brown. He's taking a stand for us, right? If you were to be able to say to people and inspire people, what would you say, Cassie, to people about a little inspiration about, you know, what you've been talking about, what people can do, but, you know, what kind of satisfaction are you getting out of your work that could enlighten people to get on board with what you're doing?
Yeah, so a couple things I wanted to say in response to some of the things you brought up. I don't think now is a time to be soft on our opinions. You know, you're right. When we see something wrong, we need to take a stand for it. And there's a lot of satisfaction that people can derive from doing what they see is the right thing. And so I wanted to mention one thing that it's a recent lawsuit by two Bay Area counties against 37 oil, gas, and coal companies, asserting that the companies knew that fossil fuel products would cause sea level rise and coastal flooding, but failed to reduce their greenhouse gas pollution.
And so I think actions like that, you know, that can be taken at the individual level, at the county level, at the state level. You were mentioning support from the governor. You know, all those levels of actions are so important to hold people accountable. So if you're part of an organization, you know, take part that way. SeaTurtles.org is the website for Turtle Island Restoration Network. But whatever level you're able to take part in, you know, go forth and find the satisfaction in that. You will have more satisfaction, you know, from voicing your opinion, meeting with your representative, you know, taking whatever action you choose than watching a TV show at home. Not nice. That there's not room for both.
Unless it's Free Willy.
I think keeping your hand on this is important. I'm seeing a lot of what clicktivism, I think they call it, where people are signing on to petitions, and the petitions are often used as a lure to bring people into a funding opportunity. The bottom line is, when we have comments to particular actions that the federal government is proposing, if a petition comes in with 1,000 signatures or even 60,000 signatures, it's just one opinion. It's evaluated as one voice. The fact that NRDC has millions and millions of people on their mail list has some bearing on the fact that they can get 100,000 signatures, and I, who have maybe 3,000 names on my mail list, if I decided to do a, you know, I can only get three. The opinion that we're expressing is not any more or less important. It has to do with another economy there. The thing that people ask a lot of, particularly with this ocean noise pollution issue, is because we're far away from it, what can we do? And I think the simplest thing is ride a bicycle. Don't buy crap from China. Maintain a regional attitude about your participation and engagement with your community. And don't look too far over the horizon to try to solve problems, because those are over the horizon. They're terrifying sometimes. I mean, I'm looking under the hood and it doesn't look very good. I'll try to do what I can, but, you know, getting engaged, getting, you know, going to Turtle Island and seeing if you can help these guys do creek restoration is super important. It's right here in town, or in Marin County anyways. Coming down to OCR, Ocean Conservation Research, and helping us with modeling or grants research, that's really helpful. We're in our 10th year, and we're having a number of different people staging. In fact, this next weekend, on the 3rd, there's a reception for an art exhibit that Judy and Art Levitt are putting up in Olema. And the proceeds of the exhibit is going to be donated to our organization. We have a couple of other art events, and we're in our 10th year anniversary, so it's a lot of anniversary things happening. But going to support your local nonprofit organization, either in kind or financially, is probably the most significant thing you can do, and still see results of that. I mean, signing, you know, chipping in $3 to some large Washington, D.C. organization is maybe good, but they're getting a lot of what's called RAGE donations right now. Southern Poverty Law Center has probably doubled their budget in the last 2 months because of they're enraged about this racist thing that's happening. Well, can they manage that? They probably can do something with it. It's good for them. They're doing good work generally. But if you took that time, energy, and money and just went down to your local, you know, social services department, you know, go down and help the folks out at you know, some health clinic, or go down to Canal Alliance and help those guys out. That's going to be more significant and make more of a difference than shipping in $3 and signing a petition.
You know who I would love to see take public transportation? Our political leaders.
Yeah.
You know, if our political leaders started taking public transportation, I think our local public transportation system would start really improving fast. You know, and that's one of the things I have an electric bike, just so you know. I have been trying to not drive at all. I've been going through, and it's hard. It's really hard. I've had to, like, reshape my entire life. And anyway, but it's just, but these electric bikes, they're pretty darn cool. And you got the wind in your face, and it's, you know, it's outdoors, it's nice. But one of the other things that I've been recognizing that I just have to throw out, because I'm embroiled in this right now, is I have a bounty on my head by the state of California for $53,000. Captain Richard Gillette, who is a bit of an icon here in the Bay Area, who's done such great work for ocean work, teaching kids about ocean acidification. He got involved in a nonprofit, which we all know, if you've never run a nonprofit, is pretty sticky business. But he bought a boat with funding. He lost the funding because it's a really hard thing to do. He gave the boat back to the owner, but there was a sales tax on that purchase of a boat for $53,000. It might have been a little less than that. It's accrued money. And when the funding went out, they didn't have a mailbox, so I raised my hand. I'm always trying to help. I'm like, you can use my mailbox. Well, that pulled me into the circuit of the state of California is looking for someone to pay $53,000 on sales tax on an organization where nobody made a buck, where somebody was trying to do a good thing. And now they're coming after me. $53,000. I'll be out on the street living in a tent before I pay a cent on that, just so you all know. but what brought this up to me on a bigger level is a systemic change in the state of California. What can the government do to help sustain organizations like yours and the good work that you guys are doing? And that's what I really want to see come out of all of it. And just so you know, I did write a letter back, and I CC'd Donald Trump and Governor Brown, so we'll have to see what happens with that letter. Nonprofit work. You guys are in it. Are you? You're in it for you want to see changes.
It's called nonprofit public benefit work.
Yeah,
that's an important. And the statute is called public benefit. We call it nonprofit, and with that comes this kind of. I don't think it's a very healthy association that we should actually be broke, and that we should be turning our pockets inside out. It is, in fact, a fundraising job. When you start a nonprofit organization, you basically have a 40-hour-a-week fundraising job. And then you have a 40-hour-a-week volunteer job doing what you're fundraising for. So I could probably make three times what I'm making now in the private sector. The issue is, what's the product of my life? And I enjoy the quality of my life. I travel a lot with my business. I've been to Europe three or four times this year. Great on carbon footprint, but doing environmental work over there with international standards organizations and things like that. And so I have a pretty comfortable life that is wrapped around this. I'm not a consumer, so that makes it possible. I don't have an acquisition yearning, so that makes it easy. I think that's part of the character of folks who are in our industry, who basically want to be engaged in ways that are healthy for our spirits.
Cassie, Turtle Island Restoration Network, how can people get involved?
So they can visit our website at seaturtles.org. Michael mentioned that we have weekly watershed restoration volunteer days on Friday mornings. And we are located out in Olema. It's a beautiful area near Point Reyes National Seashore, so you can make a fun trip of it and do a little good stewardship work in there. So we are asking for volunteers for a lot of different things depending upon your interests. I am looking for volunteers to help me launch a boycott of unsustainable swordfish. And so we are getting ready to reach out to hundreds of restaurants and markets throughout California to let them know about the unsustainability of the products that they're offering in their freezer or on their plates. And so we are going to be asking a lot of people to be making changes in the very near future, and we need people to help facilitate that. So certainly people can get in touch with me, and my name is Cassie Birdieshaw, and you can find me on our website at seaturtles.org. And I also wanted to just throw out something else that I'm thankful for that you had alluded to, that California does to sort of combat this culture that we have been building of valuing money over everything else. And so a lot of people right now see the value of a corporation, see the goal as being singular, providing a profit,
providing, you know, financial benefit to society. But there are, of course, other important benefits. And so the triple bottom line, the framework that not only accounts for financial outcomes, but also for environmental and social outcomes, is something that, you know, California has pushed forward and that many companies based here in California have embraced, and actually, you know, throughout other states and other nations as well. But so encouraging, and you know, when you are going to buy something, buying something from a company that, you know, doesn't just have a financial bottom line, but has a social and environmental bottom line as well, is the way to go.
Excellent. And Michael, your organization, the Ocean Conservation Research, what can people do to help you?
Be informed. OCR.org is the site. We also have ocean-noise.com, which is a blog. A lot of information, a lot of intriguing stuff. We have a sound library of animal sounds and anthropogenic sounds. The more informed we are, the better decisions we make. So I would say get informed, and if you want to get in touch with us, we can find something for you to do.
Excellent. I want to say thank you to Michael Stalker, Director of Ocean Conservation Research, and Cassie Birdie-Shaw, Advocacy and Policy Director, Turtle Island Restoration Network, for joining the show. Take Back, I take that to heart. We're taking back our oceans. That's what I'm going to put out there to the universe. Thanks so much for coming to the show. You're listening to Take Back. The universe loves to laugh here at 102.3 FM or worldwide radio.dominican.edu. A couple of things coming up next week. We're changing the show to Wednesdays. So you'll catch us right here next Wednesday at 12 o'clock. And we have Jen Linder of Seed, a new nonprofit organization that recently was spearheaded here in Marin County. She's addressing social economic issues and Seed's ideas for regenerating positive projects. Her most recent effort is gaining ground, quite literally. It's focused on green burials to help regrow either polluted or deforested lands. It's time to regrow those forests that have the mountaintop removals. I think that's where she's going to go, West Virginia. That's what we're going to hope for anyway. And couple of other tidbits here. On September 19th, I'm joining forces with Charlie Seiler of Climate Showdown over at Channel 26 at our local community media center of Marin. And we're going to be talking about oceans on our first show as well, Heirs to Our Oceans, a youth movement that launched a couple of years back with a group of kids who are taking a stand for their oceans. Charlie and Dakota were actually here on my show, my very first radio show, and we're going to have them for our very first show of the People's Environmental News. I can't wait to see these kids and how they can inspire. And as Michael and Cassie both said, write to your congressman. Our local one here is Jared Huffman, and he's concerned about the oceans just like all of us. Get involved. One of my favorite networks is Blue Drinks. It's a gathering of ocean advocates. You can look for them online. Surf Riders is another one, Mission Blue. These are just some of my favorite organization. And hey, we got to support these kids of the next generation. We were also talking a lot about Jimmy Carter. Well, we're in luck because his birthday is coming up. He's going to be 93. So there is our 39th president, and we're going to celebrate his 93rd birthday. How fun is that? October 1, and this is going across Marin County. We've got a bunch of events lining up. If you want to learn more about more information, you can check out Jimmy Carter Jamboree 2017.com. A big thank you to Stuart Horn, Executive Director of Penguin Radio, and to listeners here at Dominican University. This is Take Back. My name is Barbara McVeigh, and I'll catch you next Wednesday.